4. Gunnar Hofhorn didn't take his pen terminal with him when he went out that evening, and the first place he visited in Night City was a tier-syndicate Ishlorsenami tech store. The woman was small for an ishi, thought Gunnar Hofhorn, still she towered over him. She wore the usual long black robes, and she smelled musty. They sat on plain narrow seats in a bubble of blackness. The woman was bent over a tiny fold-away screen balanced on her knees. She nodded and craned her body over towards him, her hand extended close to his left ear. A sequence of shining telescoping rods extended from her fingers. She closed her eyes. In the dimness, Gunnar Hofhorn could see tiny lights flickering on the inside of her eyelids. Her hand touched his ear, tickling slightly. He felt his face twitch. "Don't move," she said. He tried to stay still. The woman withdrew her hand. She opened her eyes and peered at the point where the tips of three of the delicate rods met. She nodded and said, Gunnar Hofhorn bent forward and looked too. He couldn't see anything. The woman closed her eyes again. Her lid screens glowed. "Very sophisticated," she said. "Could have missed it." Gunnar Hofhorn looked at his right palm. "Sure there's nothing on this hand?" he asked, recalling Verliov Shung's firm handshake. "As sure as I can be," the woman said, withdrawing a small transparent container from her robe and dropping whatever she'd taken out of his ear into it. He still couldn't see anything there. "And the suit?" he asked, fingering one lapel of his jacket. "Clean," the woman said. "So that's it?" he asked. "That is all," she told him. The black bubble disappeared, and they were sitting in a small room whose walls were lined with shelves overflung with impenetrably technical-looking gear. "Well, thanks. That will be 800 tier-syndicate-hour equivalents. Oh, call it a round 1,000. He walked along Street 6 in the heart of Night City Tier. There were Night Cities throughout the developed galaxy. It was a kind of condominium franchise, though nobody seemed to know to whom the franchise belonged. Night cities varied a lot from place to place. The only certain things about them was that it would always be night when you got there, and you'd have no excuse for not having fun. Night City Tier was situated on the middle level of the world, on a small island in a shallow sea. The island was entirely covered by a shallow dome 10 kilometers across and 2 in height. Internally, the city tended to take its cue from each year's festival. The last time Gunnar Hofhorn had been here, the place had taken on the appearance of a magnified oceanscape, all its buildings turned into waves between 1 and 200 meters tall. The theme that year had been the sea. Street 6 had existed in the long trough between 2 exponentially swept surges. Ripples on the towering curves of the wave's surfaces had been balconies burning with lights. Luminous foam, at each wave's looming overhanging crest, had cast a pallid, sepulchral light over the winding street beneath. At either end of the street, the Broadway had risen to meet crisscrossing wave fronts and connect through oceanically inauthentic tunnels with other highways. The theme this year was the primitive, and the city had chosen to interpret this as a gigantic early electronic circuit board, The network of silvery streets formed an almost perfectly flat cityscape, studded with enormous resistors, dense-looking, centipedally-legged, flat-topped chips, spindly diodes, and huge, semi-transparent valves with complicated internal structures, each standing on groups of shining metal legs embedded in the network of the printed circuit. Those were the bits that Gunnar Hofoen sort of half-recognized from his History of Technical Stuff course, or whatever it had been called, when he'd been a student. There were lots of other jagged, knobbly, smooth, brightly coloured, matte black, shiny, veined, crinkled bits he didn't know the purpose or the name of. Street 6 this year was a 15-metre-wide stream of quickly flowing mercury covered with etched diamond sheeting. Every now and again, large coherent blobs of sparkling blue gold went speeding along the mercury stream underfoot. Apparently these were symbolized electrons or something. The original idea had been to incorporate the mercury channels into the city transport system, but this had proved impractical. And so they were there just for effect. The city tube system ran deep underground as usual. Gunnar Hofoen had jumped on and off a few of the underground cars on his way to the city, and on and off a couple more once he'd arrived, hoping to give the slip to anybody following. Having done this, and had the tracer in his ear removed, he was happy he'd done the best he could to ensure that his evening's fun would take place unobserved by SC, though he wasn't particularly bothered if they were still watching him. It was more the principle of the thing. No point getting obsessive about it. Street 6 itself was packed with people, walking, talking, staggering, strolling, rolling along within bubble spheres, riding on exotically accoutred animals, riding in small carriages drawn by Wiesner-Mistretel pairs, and floating along under small vacuum balloons or in force-field harnesses. Above, in the eternal night sky beneath the city's vast dome, this part of the evening's entertainment was being provided by a city-wide hologram of an ancient bomber raid. The sky was filled with hundreds and hundreds of winged aircraft, with four or six piston engines each, many of them picked out by searchlights. Spasms of light leaving black-on-black clouds and blossoming spheres of dimming red sparks were supposed to be anti-aircraft fire, while in amongst the bombers, smaller single- and twin-engined aircraft whizzed. The two sorts of aircraft were shooting at each other, the large planes from turrets and the smaller ones from their wings and noses. Gently curving lines of white, yellow, and red tracer moved slowly across the sky. And every now and again an aircraft seemed to catch fire and start to fall out of the sky. Occasionally one would explode in mid-air. All the time the dark shapes of bombs could be glimpsed, falling to explode with bright flashes and vivid gouts of flame on parts of the city seemingly always just a little way off. Gunnar Hofoen thought it all looked a little contrived, and he doubted there'd ever been such a concentrated air battle, or one in which the ground fire kept up while interceptor planes did their intercepting, but as a show it was undeniably impressive. Explosions, gunfire and sirens sounded above the chatter of people filling the street, and was sporadically submerged by the music spilling from the hundreds of bars and multifarious entertainment venues lining the street. The air was full of half-strange, half-familiar, entirely enticing smells, and wild pheromonic effects understandably banned everywhere else on tier. Gunnar Hofoen strolled down the middle of the street, a large glass of tier 9050 in one hand, a cloud cane in the other, and a small puff creant nestling on one shoulder of his immaculately presented own-skin jacket. The 9050 was a cocktail which notoriously involved about 300 separate processes to make. many of them involving unlikely and even unpleasant combinations of plants, animals, and substances. The end result was an acceptable, if strong-tasting drink, composed largely of alcohol, no more. But you didn't really drink it for the internal effects. You drank it to show you could afford to. They put it in a special crystal field goblet so you could show that you could. The name was meant to imply that after sinking a few, you were 90% certain to get laid, and 50% assured of ending up in legal trouble. Or it may have been the other way round. Gunnar Hofoen could never remember. The cloud cane was a walking stick burning compressed pellets of a mildly and brief-acting psychotropic mixture. Taking a suck on its pierced top cap was like sliding two distorting lenses in front of your eyes, sticking your head under water, and shoving a chemical factory up your nose while standing in a shifting gravity field. The puff creant was a small symbiont, half animal, half vegetable, which you paid to squat on your shoulder and cough up your nose every time you turned your face towards it. The cough contained spores that could do any one of about 30 different and interesting things to your perceptions and moods. Gunnar Hofoen was particularly pleased with his new suit. It was made of his own skin, genetically altered in various subtle ways, specially vat-grown, and carefully tailored to his exact specifications. He donated a few skin cells, too, and left the order and payment with a gene tailor here on Tyr 2.5 years earlier, when he was on his way to God's Hole habitat. It had been a whim after a drinking session, as had been an animated obscene tattoo he'd removed a month later. He hadn't really expected to pick the suit up for a while. Fortunately, long-term fashions hadn't changed too much in the interim. The suit and its accompanying cloak looked terrific. He felt great. Spadassins, Digladiates, Ziphidae and Zebex contend, Goliard dunking. Slogans, signs, announcements, odors, and personal greeters vied for attention, advertising emporia and venues. Stunning scapes and scenes played out in sensorium bubbles bulging out into the center of the street, putting you instantly into bedrooms, feast halls, arenae, harems, sea ships, fair rides, space battles, states of temporary ecstasy. Tempting, prompting, suggesting, offering, providing entrance, stimulating appetites, prompting desires, suggesting, propositioning, pandering. Riporography, colloidal anamnesis, ivress. Gunnar Hofoen walked through it all, soaking it all in, refusing all the offers and suggestions, politely turning down the overtures and come-ons, the recommendations and invitations. Zivolos, Hofferians, Rastre, Nomachia, Ali. For now, he was content just to be here, walking, promenading, watching and being watched, sizing up, and, with any luck, being sized up. It was evening, real evening, in this level of Tyr, the time when Night City started to become busy. Everywhere was open, nowhere was full. Everybody wanted your custom, but nobody was really setting on a venue yet, just cruising, grazing, petting. Gunnar Hofoen was happy to be part of that general drift. He loved this, he gloried in it. This was where he felt most himself. For now, there was simply no better place to be, and he believed in entering into the experience with all due and respectful intensity. These were his sort of people. Here was where his sort of thing happened, and this was his sort of place. Pilius Omadons invite Rasia. Lack of thalmicity guaranteed. When you see the gesticors and loricas of our martichorastic minikins. He saw her outside a Sublimus Secos set, under the rotundly swollen bulk of a building shaped like a giant resistor. The entrance to the cult's sacred place was a brightly shining loop, like a thick but tiny rainbow layered in different shades of white. Young Sublimus stood outside the enclosure, clad in glowing white robes. The Sublimus, each tall and thin, glowed too, their skin glowing gently, pallid to the point of unhealthy-looking bloodlessness. Their eyes shone, soft light spilling from the wide open whites, while the same half-silvery light was projected from their teeth when they smiled. They smiled all the time, even when they were talking. The woman was standing looking at the pair of enthusiastically gesticulating Sublimus with an expression of amused disdain. She was tall, tawny-skinned. Her face was broad, her nose thin and almost parallel with the planes of her cheeks. Her arms were crossed, her body tilted back from the two young people, her weight taken on one black-booted heel as she looked down that long nose at the shining Sublimus. Her eyes and her hair looked as dark as a featureless shadow robe which hid the rest of her frame. He stopped in the middle of the street and watched her arguing with the two Sublimus for a few moments. Her gestures and the way she held her body were different, but the face was very similar to the way he remembered her looking 40 years ago. Just a little older, perhaps. He'd always wondered how much she'd changed. But it couldn't be her. Tishlin had said she was still on board the sleeper. They'd have mentioned it if she'd left, wouldn't they? He let a group of squatly chortling Bastilians pass him, then sauntered a little way back up the street, studying the architecture of the giant valve bulging over it from the opposite pavement and sniffing from his cloud cane in a vague, bored manner, while watching a line of dark bombs flit out of the darkness above to fall and detonate somewhere beyond the line of barrel-like resistors that formed the other side of the street. Bright yellow-orange explosions lit up the sky, and debris rose slowly and fell. Further up the avenue, some sort of commotion surrounded a large animal. He turned and looked back down the crowded street. At that moment, a giant blue-gold shape slid under his feet, rushing silently along with the mercury stream beneath the diamond plate. The girl arguing with the Sublimus turned, glancing at the street as the blob went gliding past. As she looked back to the two young glowing people, she caught sight of him watching her. Her gaze settled on him for a moment, and the flicker of an expression, a glimmer of recognition, passed briefly over her face before she started talking to the Sublimus again. He hadn't had time to look away, even if he'd wanted to. He was wondering whether he ought to go over to her now, wait and see if she stepped back into the thoroughfare, and maybe approach her then, or just walk away, when a tall girl in a glowing gown stepped up to him and said, "May I help you, sir? You seem taken with our place of exaltation. Do you have any questions you'd like to ask? Is there anything I can do to enlighten you?" He turned to the Sublimer. She was almost as tall as he. Her face was pretty, but somehow vacuous, though he knew that might have been prejudice on his part. Sublimers had turned what was a normal but generally optional part of a species' choice of fate into a religion. Sublimers believed that everybody ought to sublime, that every human, every animal, every machine and mind ought to head straight for ultimate transcendence, leaving the mundane life behind and setting as direct a course as possible for nirvana. People who joined the cult spent a year trying to persuade others of this before they sublimed themselves, joining one of the sect's group minds to contemplate irreality. the few drones, other AIs and minds that became persuaded of the merit of this course of action through the arguments of the Sublimers, tended to do what any other machine did on such occasions and disappear in the direction of the nearest sublimed entity, though one or two stuck around in a pre-sublimed state long enough to help the course. In general, though, the cult was regarded as rather a pointless one. Subliming was seen as something that usually happened to entire societies, and more as a practical lifestyle alteration than a religious commitment, more like moving house than entering a sacred order. "Well, I don't know," Gunnar Hofhorn said, sounding wary. "What exactly do you people believe in again?" The Sublimer looked up the street behind him. "Oh, we believe in the power of the Sublime," she said. "Let me tell you more." She glanced up the avenue again. "Oh, perhaps we ought to get off the street, don't you think?" She held out her hand and took a step back towards the pavement. Gunnar Hofhorn looked back to where things were getting noisy. The giant animal he'd noticed earlier, a sexapedal ponderosaur, was advancing slowly down the avenue, in the midst of a retinue and a crowd of spectators. The shaggy brown-furred animal was 6 meters tall, splendidly liveried with long gaudy banners and ribbons, and commanded by a garishly uniformed mahout brandishing a fiery mace. The beast was surmounted by a glitteringly black and silver cupola, whose bulbously filigreed windows gave no hint of who or what might be inside. Similarly ornamented bowls covered the great animal's eyes. It was attended by 5 loping cleistrithals, each black-tusked creature pawing at the street surface and snorting, and held on a tight lead by a burly hire guard. A knot of people held the procession up. The ponderosaur paused and put its long head back to let out a surprisingly soft, subdued roar. Then it adjusted its eye-cups with its 2 lengthic forelimbs and bobbed its head to either side. The gaggle of promenaders began to disperse, and the great beast and its escorts moved forward again. "Yes," Gunnar Hofhorn said, "perhaps we'd better move out of the way." He finished the 90-50 and looked round for a place to deposit the empty container. "Please, allow me." The Sublimer girl took the field goblet from him as though it was some sort of holy object. Gunnar Hofhorn followed her onto the sidewalk. She put an arm through his, and they proceeded slowly towards the entrance to the Seacos, where the woman was still standing, talking to the other 2 Sublimers with her look of ironic curiosity.
"Have you heard of Sublimers before?"
the girl on his arm asked.
"Oh, yes," he said, watching the other woman's face as they approached.
They stopped on the pavement outside the Sublimer building, entering a hush field in which the only sound was gently tinkling music and a background of waves on a beach.
"You believe everybody should just sort of disappear up their own arses, don't you?" he asked, with every appearance of innocence.
He was only a few meters from the woman in the shadow robe, though the compartment at Hushfield meant he couldn't hear what she was saying. Her face was much like he remembered it. The eyes and mouth were the same. She'd never worn her hair up like that, but even its shade of black-blue was the same.
"Oh, no," the Sublimer girl said, her expression terribly serious. "What we believe in takes one completely away from such bodily concerns."
Out of the corner of his eye he could see up the street, where the ponderosaur was shuffling forwards through a thick crowd of admirers. He smiled at the Sublimer girl as she talked on. He shifted a little so that he could see the other woman better.
No, it wasn't her. Of course it wasn't. She'd have recognized him. She'd have reacted by now. Even if she'd been trying to pretend she hadn't seen him, he'd have been able to tell. She'd never been very good at hiding her feelings from anybody, least of all from him. She glanced at him again, then quickly away. He felt a sudden, unbidden sensation of fearful pleasure, a jolt of excitement which left his skin tingling. Highest expression of our quintessential urge to be greater than we. He nodded and looked at the Sublimer Girl, who was still babbling away. He frowned a little and stroked his chin with his free hand, still nodding. He kept watching the other woman. Out on the street, the Ponderosaur and its retinue had come to a stop almost alongside them. A tierce syndicate was hovering level with the giant animal's mahout, who seemed to be arguing angrily with it. The woman was smiling at the other two Sublimers, with what appeared to be an expression of tolerant ridicule. She kept her eyes on the Sublimer fellow doing the talking at that point, but took a long, deep breath, and, just as she let it out, glanced at Gunnar Hofhoen again, with the briefest of smiles and a flick of her eyebrows, just before looking back at the Sublimers, and tipping her head just a little to one side. He wondered, would S.C. really go this far to keep him under their control, or at least under their eyes? How likely was it that he should find somebody who looked so much like her? He supposed there must be hundreds of people who bore a passing resemblance to Jejeal Galion. Perhaps there were even a few who had heard something about her and deliberately assumed her appearance. That happened all the time with genuinely famous people. And just because he'd never heard of anybody taking on Dejael's looks didn't mean nobody had ever done so. If this person was one of them, it was just possible he would have to be on his guard. Personal ambition, or the desire to better oneself, or to provide opportunities for one's children, is but a pale reflection of, compared to the ultimate transcendence which true subliming offers. For as it is written... Gunnar Hofhoen leant closer to the girl talking to him and tapped her lightly on the shoulder. "I'm sure," he said quietly. "Would you excuse me for just a moment?" He took the two steps over to the woman in the shadow robe. She turned her head from the two Sublimers and smiled politely at him. "Excuse me," he asked, "don't I know you from somewhere?" He grinned as he said it, acknowledging both the well-worn nature of the line and the fact that neither he nor she was really interested in what the Sublimers had to say. She nodded her head politely to him. "I don't think so," she said. Her voice was higher than Dejael's, more girlish, and with quite a different accent. "Though if we had met, and you hadn't altered in some way, and I'd forgotten, certainly I'd be far too ashamed to admit it." She smiled. He did the same. She frowned. "Unless... do you live on Tyr?" "Just passing through," he told her. A bomber in flames tore past just overhead and exploded in a burst of light behind the Sublimer building. On the street, the argument around the Ponderosaur seemed to be getting more heated. The animal itself was staring intently at the syndicate, and its mahout was standing up on its neck, pointing the flaming mace at the dark, spiny being to emphasize whatever points he was making. "But I've been this way before," Gunnar Hofhoen said. "Perhaps we bumped into each other then." She nodded thoughtfully. "Perhaps," she conceded. "Oh, you two know each other," said the young Sublimer man she'd been talking to. Well, many people find that subliming in the company of a loved one, or just somebody they know, is...
Do you play Callisthenic Crisis? She asked, cutting across the young sublimer. You may have seen me at a game here.
She put her head back, looking down that long nose at him.
If so, I'm disappointed you left it till now to say hello.
Ah, the young sublimer lad said, games, an expression of the urge to enter into worlds beyond ourselves. Another. I've never even heard of the game, he confessed. Do you recommend it?
Oh, yes, she said, and sounded ironic. It benefits all who play.
Well, I'm always willing to entertain some new experience. Perhaps you could teach me.
Oh, now, the ultimate new experience, began the sublimer lad.
Gunnar Hofer turned to him and said, Oh, shut up.
It had been an instinctive reaction, and for a moment he was worried he might have said the wrong thing. But she didn't seem to be regarding the young sublimer's hurt look with any great degree of sympathy. She looked back to him.
All right, she said, you stand me my stake, and I'll teach you crisis.
He smiled, wondering if that had been too easy.
It's a deal, he said.
He waved the cloud cane under his nose and took a deep breath, then bowed.
My name's Byer. Pleased to meet you.
She nodded again.
Call me Flynn, she said,
and taking hold of the cane, waved it under her own nose.
Shall we, Flynn, he said,
and indicated the street beyond, where the ponderosaur had sunk to its belly, its four legs doubled up underneath it, and both forelimbs folded beneath its chin, as though bored.
Two syndricates were shouting at the enraged Mahout, who was shaking the flaming mace at them.
The higher guards were looking nervous and patting the restless Cleistrithros.
Certainly. Remember where you met, the sublimer called after them. Subliming is the ultimate meeting of souls, the pinnacle of...
They left the hush field. His voice was drowned out by the thudding of projected anti-aircraft fire as they walked along the pavements.
So, where are we going? He asked her.
Well, you can take me for a drink, and then we'll hit a crisis bar, I know.
Sound all right.
Sounds fine.
Shall we take a trap, he said, pointing a little way up the street, to a two-wheeled open vehicle waiting by the curb.
A Weissner Miss Strettel pair were harnessed between the traces, the Weissner craning its long neck down to peck at a feed bag in the gutter, the small, smartly uniformed Miss Strettel on its back, looking around alertly and tapping its thumbs together.
Good idea, she said.
They walked up to the trap and climbed aboard.
The Collyrium Lounge, the woman said to the Miss Strettel, as they sat in the rear of the small vehicle.
It saluted and pulled a whip out from its fancy jerkin. The Weissner made a sighing noise. The trap shook suddenly. A great, deep burst of noise came from the street behind them. They all looked round. The ponderosaur was rearing up, bellowing. Its mahout nearly fell off its neck. His mace tumbled from his grasp and bounced on the street. Two of the Cleistrithros jumped up and leapt into the crowd, snarling and dragging their handlers with them. The two syndricates who'd been arguing with the mahout rose quickly into the air out of the way. People in float harnesses took avoiding action through the confusion of searchlight beams and anti-aircraft fire.
Flynn and Gunnar Hofoen watched people scatter in all directions, as the ponderosaur leapt forward with surprising agility and started charging down the street towards them.
The mahout clung desperately to the beast's ears, screeching at it to stop.
The stabilized black and silver cupola on the animal's back seemed to float along above it, until the animal's increasing speed forced it to oscillate from side to side. At Gunnar Hofhorn's side, Flynn seemed frozen. Gunnar Hofhorn glanced round at the Mistrettle. "Well," he said, "let's get going." The little Mistrettle blinked quickly, still staring up the street. Another bellow echoed off the surrounding buildings. Gunnar Hofhorn looked back again. The charging Ponderosaur reached up with one forelimb and ripped its eye cups off to reveal huge faceted blue eyes like chunks of ancient ice. With its other limb, it gripped the Mahout by one shoulder and wrenched him off its neck. He wriggled and flailed, but it brushed him to one side and onto the pavement. He landed running, fell, and rolled. The Ponderosaur itself thundered on down the streets. People threw themselves out of its way. Somebody in a bubble sphere didn't move fast enough. The giant transparent ball was kicked to the side, smashing into a hot food stall. Flames leapt from the wreckage. "Shit," Gunnar Hofhorn said, as the giant bore down upon them. He turned to the Mistrettle driver again. He could see the face of the Weissner turned back to look up the street behind, too, its big face expressing only mild surprise. "Move!" he shouted. The Mistrettle nodded. "Goo idea," it chirped. It reached behind to slip a knot on the rear of the Weissner and jabbed its boot heels into the animal's lower neck. The startled Weissner took off, leaving the trap behind. The vehicle tipped forward as the Weissner-Mistrettle pair disappeared down the rapidly clearing street. Gunnar Hofhorn and Flynn were thrown forward in a tangle of harnesses. He heard her shout, "Fuck!" then "Oof!" as they hit the street. Something hit him hard on the head. He blacked out for a moment, then came to, looking up at a huge face, a monstrous face gazing down at him with huge prismed blue eyes. Then he saw the woman's face, the face of Djelka Lion. She had blood on her top lip. She looked groggily at him, then turned to gaze up at the huge animal face looking down at them. There was a sort of buzzing sensation from somewhere. Gunnar Hofhorn felt his legs go numb. The woman collapsed over his legs. He felt sick. Lines of red dots crossing the sky floated behind his eyelids when they closed. When he forced his eyes open again, she was there. Somebody looking like Djelka Lion who wasn't her. Except it wasn't Flynn either. She was dressed differently. She was taller, and her expression was not the same. And anyway, Flynn was still draped unconscious over his legs. He really didn't understand what was going on. He shook his head. "This hurts." The girl who wasn't to jail or Flynn stooped quickly, looked into his eyes, whirled the cloak off her shoulders and onto the street beside him in one movement, then rolled him over onto it, heaving Flynn's immobile body out of the way as she did so. He tried waving his arms around, but it didn't do much good. The cloak went rigid underneath him and floated into the air, wrapping around him. He cried out and tried to fight against its enclosing black folds. But the buzzing came again, and his vision faded, even before the cloak finished wrapping itself round him.